I'm Frank Jones. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Bob and the folks that are responsible for having me here today, and I'm grateful to be here, and it is good to be sober, and I've loved the meeting so far and the talks, and I am speaking on step 8 and 9, and if I'd have known I was going to do this, I'd probably work the damn things by now, but it's not easy, I got to tell you. And if you're relatively new to Alcoholics Anonymous and you've attended the meetings, I know you're just absolutely thrilled to know that you can't drink worth a damn and you don't know how to run your life, that you have a problem with insanity. You probably now have been told that you got to believe in a God or higher power that you don't believe in. You got to write out everything you've done, and then you got to read it to somebody. And Larry eloquently explained all the things wrong with you. So I know you're just feeling like a champ right now. Yeah, I'm a winner. I'm all over this one. I like it. You see, because when I was out there drinking, I never did anything that my head didn't say it was okay to do. Everything I did, my head said it was okay or I wouldn't have done it. In sobriety, everything I do, my head says it's okay or I wouldn't be doing it. That's sad. That's why I have a sponsor. And before I make most of my decisions, I run it by him. Because my thinker's broke. I got to tell you this, that when I first got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, I actually said this at a participation meeting when they made the mistake of calling on me. I never hurt anybody with my drinking but me. That's sad to even think that way. And then when the process of Alcoholics Anonymous and the things that we learn here and the things that we read and the things that we do, for me, I have to tell you that at 10 years sober, my sponsor told me to quit trying to be what the group wanted me to be. I grew up in Alcoholics Anonymous in a group that was very active, very successful, and damn near everybody in that group was an example. Everybody worked. Everybody at the meetings that I seen them at treated everybody right. They shook hands. They were friendly. They were sincere. At least I thought they were. And I wanted to be like them. Therefore, the things that you've heard talked about today kept eating me up, and I kept thinking, I can't be like them. I had so much insanity in my head and so much grinding in my gut, and I had done so many bad things to so many people that there's no way I could reach the level that those people were at. And that's how I felt. I almost left Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had 10 years sober. And then my sponsor snapped me up and told me, you don't have to be what this group wants you to be. You have to find out who you are and what you are and start working on that. And I had done an inventory. I had read it. I had talked about my defects of character and shortcomings. Unlike some of the other speakers, I had a great mom and dad. I was born in Illinois, and mom and dad were married to each other 50 years. My dad worked on the railroad, and my mom took care of me and my two brothers. I was raised in the Catholic Church. I was made to go to church. I was baptized. I went to confession. I first communion. I was confirmed. I had a good upbringing, the way a kid should be brought up in that religion with that family in the Midwest. I was astonishingly lucky to have had the childhood I had. I don't know where I went wrong. I have grave emotional and mental disorders. That is not a joke. That is me. A lot of people here have heard me speak before, and you know that. I am not naturally a kind, loving individual. I really don't give a rat's ass about most people. I'm just being honest with you. I'm not trying to be funny. I am being very serious. And I had to learn in Alcoholics Anonymous how to act better than I felt. Because my answer to any type of emotional discomfort or upheaval is to pop you in the mouth. That was from grade school on. I never heard my father raise his voice to my mother, and they were married 50 years. So I don't know where these things come from. My brothers and I didn't fight. I didn't fight. I know I had a lot of fear, and I was ashamed of that because I wanted to be macho, but I don't know where those came from. And from a very early age, I could have started making my list for amends. I started shoplifting and stealing at a very early age. Mom would give me money to go to the store for and give me the list. I would shoplift the items, add the amounts up, get the change, keep the money, and give her her change in the groceries. That was by third or fourth grade. I was also fighting by then. I disrespected my parents, and there was no reason to do that. I don't know where that came from. I was fighting, causing trouble, lying and cheating and stealing. And I really, in my mind, didn't think that it hurt anybody. I really didn't think that it had an effect on their lives because they're adults. And that's how I was. When I started drinking, I played athletics in high school. I won 9 varsity letters. I had a scholarship offer to go to college and play basketball. My dad was proud of that, even though in my mind he really didn't care. That was my perception. I don't know where these problems came from to start with. I just had them. And after I'd started drinking, I went downhill from there. Besides disrespecting them, disrespecting my brothers, disrespecting any girl I dated in school, I didn't beat her for Christ's sakes. I'm not like Larry. I guess I didn't get that low. If anybody thinks they got here being an angel, raise your hand. Thank you. But I went downhill from there. My stealing got worse, my drinking got worse, my fighting got worse. I never think I affected anybody around me. 2 weeks before I was supposed to graduate high school, I quit high school. I had a fear of going to college. Because what if I didn't make the team or get good enough grades to stay? It filled me with fear, but what my head told me is I am tired of school. Now, I didn't think about what effect that had on my parents. I didn't think how that hurt them. I didn't think about their disappointment. I thought about me because I'm self-obsessed, self-absorbed, and self-centered. And so I quit high school and I joined the Marine Corps. Exactly. You should never go into the Marine Corps if you're afraid of the dark and you feel like a wimp and a wussy. You should join the Navy. Oh, all you sailors, deal with it, Jesus. And I struggled and got through boot camp. We had blanket parties for people that couldn't do things right, and I led those, which means we pounded on those young men. I didn't feel guilty about that for a long time. I couldn't tell anybody about my fear, and I had to learn to put a facade out there of what I thought a man should act like. I stole in the Marine Corps. I fought in the bars. And I made a stripe and lost it and then got in all kind of trouble, and then finally I perceived that the cab drivers overseas were ripping us servicemen off, and so I was going to get my money back, and I beat a cab driver's face in with a rock, and I was put in a brig. I didn't think that bothered anybody. I didn't think about his family. I didn't think about his wife, how hard he had to work. I didn't care. I cared about me and getting mine. My father flew to Okinawa at his own expense to try to save his son, who, when he joined the Marine Corps, which is me, he dropped me off in front of the train station, and I said, I ain't writing, I ain't calling, and I'm not going to talk to you no more. And he said, I don't care, get out of the car. He flew over there. He paid for that man's surgery. He paid for his retirement. He gave the cab company an amount of money. Now, he didn't have it, but those things didn't affect me, and I didn't think about it. But I didn't think I owed an amends to anybody when I got sober. This is also a disease of delusion if you're an alcoholic of my type. I didn't get thrown out of the Marine Corps when that happened. It was 1963 and 64, and it wasn't the way it is today. And he just talked to the commanding general, and they sent me back to duty after 337 days in that brig. In that brig, I stole. I beat up other prisoners. I broke a guard's jaw. I thought he deserved it. I had no caring or feeling about the people around me. I married a woman and took her to Camp Lejeune with me, and she wants me to stay home, and I can't. I have to drink in the bars now. I would abuse her verbally and emotionally, and that would give me my excuse to leave that house. Some of the pain that I would feel over acting that way, alcohol took away. When we had a child, I had to be the boss, and I would shake that little girl and throw her in her crib and then yell and scream at my wife and blame her. That would give me the excuse to go drink. Alcohol took away the guilt of being a bad father. When I got sober, I didn't think I owed them an amends, because if they didn't act that way, I wouldn't have acted that way. This disease tells me, when I'm drinking, that I'm a good father. I don't know what it tells you. It tells me I'm a good father. Look where we live, look how we eat, look what they wear. I'm a good dad. My head tells me I'm a good husband. That's what my head tells me. I volunteered and went to Vietnam. I did not think about what my wife had to do to raise that little girl. And when I went to Vietnam, she was pregnant. I had no concern for her. I thought what I was doing was okay. I was validating me. In the interim of all of that, I had affairs, and I didn't think they bothered her. As Larry said, it's my business. I'm still providing. I'm still doing the things that I'm supposed to do. I didn't know what integrity was or fidelity. I went to Vietnam. I was a sniper. I was over in 67, 68. And I drank. And I did a lot of bad things to a lot of people. Things I probably shouldn't have done. In my mind, it's all just a part of war. I didn't think about impact, emotions, or anything else. When I got wounded over during the siege of Khe Sanh and come home, I had found out, I don't usually say this in my talk because it's not about my wife. It's about me when I speak. She had gone out on me when I was over there, and her and I were having an argument and a fight, and my son had been born to us, my daughter, and I didn't think she had the right to do that. I mean, after all, I'm a veteran, for Christ's sakes. And I threatened to kill her, and I went in the closet and got a gun out and come back in that kitchen to shoot that woman. I didn't think about repercussions or the consequences of my actions. In my mind, she didn't shut up, so she deserved it. My daughter was standing there, and I couldn't get the safety off that gun, and I pushed a pin in at the base of the receiver. It was a firing pin, and the gun went off. And a bullet went through my hand down where my daughter was. Shortly after that, we divorced. I didn't think about the effect of that gunshot on that little girl. It didn't hit her, so there's no harm, no foul. I didn't think about my wife and what she had gone through and what I had done to her. That's how my life was, drinking. I went back to Vietnam a second time and repeated my bad actions from the first time and did a lot of bad things over it. These are the amends I have to make after I did that fifth step with my sponsor. After I got out of the Marine Corps after 11 years, I became a police officer. If you scared me on the streets, I beat you. I didn't think there was anything wrong with that. The courts ain't going to do nothing. I will. If you didn't do things right or you lipped off to me, I'd plant dope on you, pencil whip you, and take you to jail. I didn't think there was anything wrong with that. My head says it's okay, they're criminals anyway. I don't know how you were when you were drinking. I don't know what sobriety means to you. I got remarried, we had a daughter, and my wife got pregnant. I still had to have an affair with my partner, who was a female. Her and I had an affair. She found out I got my wife pregnant. She shot me. I didn't think about her, what she went through, how it affected her, the emotional impact it had on her or my wife or my children. This is just what guys do. I left the department, I got a job in real estate, and I made a lot of money. I was a big deal. I had an ego that was out of control, and I'd buy things for everybody in the restaurant. I'd take their checks. I didn't think I was taking money from my family. I was making plenty. I had affairs when I was in real estate, and I didn't think about the consequences that I was never home with my children or my wife or anything else. I ended up homeless and on the streets at the age of 36, and I got very sick. I didn't communicate with my wife and my family. I didn't communicate with my parents, and I got sober. A woman that I had worked real estate with had taken me to a doctor, and then my parents found out I was dying on the streets and had me committed. My dad paid for that out of his pocket. He didn't have insurance, and he paid for that. I hadn't spoke to them in 4 years, but I figured that was the least he could do. Now, I don't know if you think I owe any amends or not. When I got here, I didn't think so. My head told me everything I did was okay. I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 steps and these 12 traditions. And I didn't go to meetings after I was introduced to it for 13 months. And my wife and kids told me I got a lot worse then than I ever was drinking. And I was verbally abusive. And I was carrying a gun. And I was acting the way I used to act. That's without Alcoholics Anonymous. I threw an old lady's groceries all over a grocery store because she had more than 10 items in the 10-item line. I thought I was justified in doing that because she had about 13 items. That's what my head says. I put a gun in a guy's face for driving too slow on the freeway and threatened to kill him. If he wasn't driving that way, I wouldn't have done it. So it's really not my fault, it's his. I don't know how you think, with or without AA. I only know how I think. I only know and can think about the job that my group had when I got there for me to be here today. I'm surprised that, well, probably half of them did. What an order. I can't go through with it. Huh, Sharon? But that's how I was until I flipped out with a nervous breakdown and got taken to my sponsor and my home group. And I didn't think I owed an amends to anybody. I figured I quit drinking, I'm sober, I'm okay. I found out that I had to make a list of all persons I had harmed and become willing to make amends to them all. Now, you may think that that only includes the people that's in your inventory. In my case, it was not. Because I left a lot of people out that I didn't think needed to be in there. I didn't have a resentment against them. I didn't feel guilt. I didn't feel fear. I didn't feel anything. And so they didn't need to be in that inventory. I was told that I needed to sit down and go over my life and look at all these things when I started telling my sponsor about the things I had done and how they affected the people around me, not how they affected me, because I'm immaterial in that process right there. I needed to look at them and what I did to them. What I did to them emotionally, what I did to them physically, what I did to them financially, how I let them down. Now, when you're a blackout drinker, trying to remember all of that is difficult. And I had to make a list. And let me tell you this right off, too. This will probably irritate some of you, but I really don't care. My sponsor didn't tell me, I want you to put yourself on the top of that list. That is horse shit, okay? I mean, I'm just going to tell you. If you think you have to make amends to yourself, you have bigger mental disorders than you really think. I don't know. I haven't met anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous to this day. I've been sober 28 years, 11 months, and change. I haven't met anybody to this day that was working for charities out there and doing good for people and going to church and praying and giving and being wonderful. They may act like it when they get here, but they weren't. If you're like me, everything you did out there was for your benefit, to make you feel good, to get you money, to get you prestige, to get you image, to get you something. You didn't do anything for anybody else if you're like me. If somebody tells you to put your name at the top of the list, in my opinion, they're trying to kill you. And I wouldn't hang around them. I started at my childhood with my parents. They not only were disappointed and let down and spent a lot of money on me to try to save me and help me, that they had to be first. Then my brothers. I had two of them. One of them died, sober. How I treated them. What I did to them. The things I stole from them. The times that I smacked both of them around. They're bigger than me, but that's the way it goes. I had to have them on the list. All the way back to elementary school, the guy I punched in the face in third grade and broke his nose. It ain't just the people on your inventory, because he wasn't in it. The way I treated the teachers, the way I treated people in the school system, the way I treated my teammates, and I didn't give them the 100%. I had to have all those people on there. The United States Marine Corps. Because I didn't give them 100%. I embarrassed them. I cost them money. So they had to be on there. The police department where I worked, from the things I cost the city, I had to have my first wife on there and my second wife. I had to put them on there. I had to put my children on there. That was a given. All the people in real estate that I ripped off, messed over, the offices I disrupted, the seminars and training sessions that I disrupted and cost people money. The two golf pro shops I tore up when I was drunk and beat the pro's ass. They took my club membership, but that should have been enough. But I had to put them on there. I had to put down aunts and uncles and grandmas. My dad's brother had his father-in-law living with him, and he was blind. When my uncle went to work and my aunt went to work, I'd sneak in the house because he couldn't see me and steal cash out of the drawer when my uncle kept it when I was a kid. I had to put them on the list. I had to go over my entire life. It ain't just about what you put in step five, because you won't remember everything if you're like me. I had a list of amends to make that was pages more than my inventory. And when I looked at it originally, I thought, I don't owe these people an apology. I mean, they went on with their life, so what? I don't know what your attitude is when you have already done your fifth step and talked about your defects of character and shortcomings, and you have to make that list of amends. I don't know what your thought process is. I don't know how good you think you were. It all opened up to me how bad I was. Actually, I had no redeeming qualities. Probably to this day, I have very few. I am not a wonderful human being today. I make a lot of amends to a lot of people. You probably can't tell, but I'm still intense. I'm very outspoken. I'm very opinionated. I judge everybody. I'm critical. And a lot of people I speak to, they think I'm abrasive. Well, I am. And I don't use it as a cop-out that I'm trying. I am me. I had to learn to be comfortable in my own skin, not at your expense, but for my sanity. And I don't have to, what you see today is what you get. I am not a phony. And I'm not a nice guy. But in Alcoholics Anonymous, what I try to do is to help anybody that needs help in this program. I really don't like civilians. I don't like people that ain't in AA. I just don't. And that's just me. But I really put an effort in to being a good AA member. And I'm not all the time. I say things I shouldn't. I act the way I shouldn't. And it doesn't matter how much time you have. It's just me. But I love Alcoholics Anonymous. It saved my sanity, is what it's done. That's just the bottom line. So I had to make that list, and I had to go through my entire life. And by the time I did that, there was people in my home group I had to make amends to. And a lot of my neighbors and everything else. The ninth step says, made direct amends wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. I thought, ha-ha, I don't have to really make all these amends. I'm going to get away with some. Because I really didn't think that I needed to make those amends because it probably hurt them or others. Well, that's not a cop-out step. That's a step that you have to put an effort into. For me, I don't know about you, but I know for me, I had to put an effort into it. And I went to the folks that were on that list. And I made those amends to my dad and my mom and my brothers and my wives and my kids and the people in the group that I had offended repeatedly. And what I had to learn to do is try not to repeat those things and to do them again. And that's hard for me. Maybe not for you, but for me it's very difficult. And there's a lot of things that I had on that list, a lot of people and organizations and individuals and schools and things that I didn't know how I was going to do that. I talked to my sponsor, and by then I'd started to make some friends. I'm going to tell you how sick Larry is. He and I are friends. So there's one I got here. That's why there's only six pallbearers at a funeral. In my case, those two guys are going to have to drag that goddamn casket down the aisle. They ain't going to be able to lift it. Because that's about the friends I have. I have a lot of respect for a lot of people in AA. But what I had to do is, besides making a list of things I had done physically, I had to make a list of financial amends. And I stole a lot of stuff. And I didn't know how I was going to make direct amends. And the places I could, I did. And then the places I can't, overseas, I've been in 27 foreign countries. I can't do it there. So what my sponsor told me to do, and this was back in the early 80s, he says, you put $2 in the basket, one for AA and one for somebody you stole from that you'll never see again. I said, well, when can I stop? He said, I'll let you know. He hasn't let me know yet. He's also upped it. I now have to put $5 in the basket at every meeting, three for AA and two for somebody I stole from I'll never see again. And I still do that to this day. And I go to 4 or 5 meetings a week and I put $5 in the basket. I had to go around to these folks and do that. I owed my dad a lot of money. He paid for my hospital bills. I owed him over $82,000. I didn't ask him to come over to Okinawa and get me out of the brig. That's his problem, not mine. My sponsor said no. He wasn't planning a vacation there. He was coming over to get your ass out of the brig. You owe him the plane fare, the hotel, and everything he paid. You beat the cab driver, he didn't. So everything he paid, you get a figure from him, you start paying him. He put you in that hospital to save your life, you owe him that money. Pay him back for that hospital visit. And I set up a payment plan for my dad. That's what I had to do. I spent a year in the Marine Corps in the brig, and when I got out, I was still drinking. I had to make that year up at the end of my enlistment of 4 years. So I did 5 years on my first enlistment. That's the way it was back then. Anytime you had lost time, you had to make it up. At the end of your enlistment, they extended you out. But I was drinking. And I went to my sponsor in 1984 and said, you know, this still bothers me a little bit that I didn't give him good time. I was still drinking and fighting and in the bars and stuff. I said, I'm going to try to go back into Marine Corps Reserve. And he said, well, submit your paperwork, kid, and see what they say. I had been out 13 years. And I submitted my paperwork to headquarters, Marine Corps, to reenlist in the Marine Corps Reserve. They took me back. I was old. I was in my 40s. Everybody in the Marine Corps Reserve is in their teens and 20s. They run my butt into the ground. I did my year, and I went to my sponsor and said, I did a year, good time, and talked to the young men and women in the Marine Corps Reserve. Can I get out now? And my sponsor said, when would you get a retirement if you stayed in? I said, 8 more years. He said, I'll tell you when you can get out, kid. That's one of those. Desert Storm happened in 1990. And I went to my sponsor. I was speaking all over the U.S. and everything. I was a big deal. And I went to my sponsor and told him, I'm in the Marine Corps Reserve, Clance. I made my amends and stuff. I can just get out anytime I want. And I know our unit's going to be activated. Can I get out? He said, when's your contract up with him? I said, in 2 years. He said, pack your sea bag, kids. You're going. I got activated for Desert Storm. I was gone almost a year. What's funny about that is we went over and staged in Okinawa. There is no time in my life I would have ever had that opportunity. I got to go speak in the brig I was locked up in. I got to tell those guys in their orange jumpsuits that your life's not over because you're in here. Because they came to the AA meeting and I said, if you put your life into AA, your life will change and you'll never have to come back to someplace like this. And I got to make amends. I got to go out in the Ville and make amends, and some of the mamasans that worked those bars were still there, and they remembered me. It had been 30 years. And I gave them money, and I kept my young troops, because I was the company gunnery sergeant, I kept them out of trouble. I got to tip the cab drivers a lot more than I would have ordinarily, as part of my amends. I'd have never had that opportunity had I not been sober, had I not had a sponsor, had he not directed me to do what I was to do. Very few people get that opportunity when they've done something far away. I got to do that. I got to stay in the Marine Corps and I retired a sergeant major. Your tax money gives me a check every month, and I want to thank you. I just want you to know that me and my wife are grateful. So that's an amends I got to make. An amends I had that was hard was my first wife. I had to make direct amends to her. I went to my daughter's graduation from high school. I was a little less than 4 years sober. I wasn't well yet. And he said, well, while you're back there, why don't you go on and make amends to her? She'll be there. Okay. I went to that graduation, and I'm sitting there in that auditorium. And she walked in. And I was sorry I didn't shoot her. I wasn't going to make amends to her. If I could have got within arm's reach, I'd have choked her. That's how I felt at that point in time. I had to leave the auditorium and call my sponsor and tell him I can't make the amends. I'll do something stupid if I do. He said, then stay away from her right now and don't say anything to her. After my daughter graduated, the reception was at my parents' house, and she showed up. I called my sponsor and said, I think I'm okay now. I just said the serenity prayer over and over and over. He said, all right, pull her aside and make your amends. Tell her you're sorry for the part you played in making her life uncomfortable and miserable. Her and I stepped outside, and I said that to her. And she said, I accept your apology. I almost drilled her. I thought, where's yours? Apologize to me, huh? I didn't get that way just out of the clear blue. You had something. It ain't about her. It's about me. I have to clean my side of the street, not her side of the street. And I haven't had any heartburn about her since then. I have to remember what she did with my daughter and my son. She did the best she could. My actions, I don't know about your actions, but my actions when I was out there drinking was pretty pathetic and bad. I made that statement when I shared one night at our Tuesday meeting that I didn't hurt anybody when I was out there but me. I had about 14 months sober. I'll tell you how I hurt them. And you can give this some thought. When I got sober, the two daughters that were living with me and my second wife was 3 and 8 years old. Now, I apologize to those kids. I made amends to them just the way I was told to do by my sponsor. And they cried. Somebody asked me Thursday, I spoke at Johnny's Under the Bridge meeting on the steps 8 and 9. And somebody asked me, have you ever had to make an amends for making an amends? I said, yeah, to my daughters. Because I made them cry. I didn't want to do that. That wasn't my goal. So I had to make another amends for making him cry. My youngest daughter was 3. She never told me she loved me or hugged me until she was 6. I had to be 3 years sober in my group, working hard at trying to do this deal just to get her to that point where she could say she loved me. If you don't think you hurt the people around you, you need to rethink that if you're like me. I can make an excuse and rationalization for everything. Because of making amends to them, I have a relationship with those kids today. That daughter I almost shot that day in Oceanside as general counsel for a medical corporation. When she got married, and when she had her son, she named him after me. That ain't because I'm a good man or a good dad. I'm not a good dad. I made an effort to be a good member of AA. I made an effort to take the book to heart, the steps to heart, the traditions to heart, and everything my sponsor said to heart. As a result of that, I have a relationship with her, I got to spend Thanksgiving with her this year and my four grandkids. My middle daughter has a master's degree and teaches fifth grade. Her and I talk two or three times a week. I love my daughters. They're great. It's because of Alcoholics Anonymous and these 12 steps that we stand here and balk at sometimes. I don't want to do my inventory. Then get out. That's all. Don't do it. It's your life. You're playing, you bet your life. What is your life worth? What is comfort and a quiet head? What is that worth when you've destroyed, if you're like me, everything around you? I don't know what that's worth to you. But I'm going to tell you, the benefit I got from making those amends with my daughters eye to eye, I got back a hell of a lot more than I put into it. And when I hear people say I'm overpaid, yes, indeed, I'm overpaid. I know that. That youngest daughter that took 3 years to tell me she loved me and give me a hug, I was going to a meeting one night, and she crawled up on my lap. She gave me a hug. She said, I love you, Dad. If that's the only thing I got in sobriety my entire 28 years, that's enough. It's enough for me. I don't know what's enough for you. I don't know. But it was enough for me. The easiest thing to lose in sobriety is your gratitude. The hardest thing to get back is that gratitude. You get a little time you think they owe you. They need to do for you now. Larry said it. Everybody else that spoke said it. Selfish and self-centeredness. I have a relationship with that little girl today. She's not little anymore. She's a police officer. She finished in the top five in the academy at LAPD, 32-week academy. I met her partner when she did her year probation at Rampart. And I told him, if my daughter is ever in the hospital and I get called and she's been injured, when I arrive there, you need to be injured too, even if it's self-inflicted. He looked at my daughter and says, is that right? And she said, oh, yeah. He ain't well. You know, I made amends to my son for being a bad father. My son's in prison today. He can't get this deal. He spent 13 out of 17 years of his life in state prison. He came to our group when he was 18 years old. He couldn't get it. He was too tough. He wouldn't drop his image. He's a tough guy. He's macho. He's got the prison attitude. Just wanted to hit on all the women and shit. Probably hit on you, Polly. I don't know. He's 40 now. And he got sober and clean in N.A. because I told him, maybe you're not an alcoholic, Dave. You didn't drink. Maybe you're just a drug addict. And he went to N.A. and he got sober. And him and his girlfriend broke up. And he went back out. Now, there's a reason to go out, huh? Like there ain't enough women in A.A. and N.A. And he got stopped and he had crack and heroin and baggies and scales and two handguns and a sawed-off shotgun and a ski mask on him. That was his fourth strike. I don't visit my son. I don't take collect calls from him. You may think that's harsh. Nobody put a gun to his head and made him do the things he did. He made a conscious decision to do it like we do when we go back out. I can drink tonight if I want to. I got money on me. Nobody's ever going to hold a gun to your head and make you go back out. No one will hold a gun on you in AA and make you work this program. It's a choice. He had a choice. He chose to do crime. I love my son. But I'm in here. I'm not out there. If he wants a relationship with me, he needs to be in here. This is the only place in the world that will save your life if you're an alcoholic of my type. It'll save your sanity. It'll put you in the center of your life with your family. I divorced a woman after 31 years of marriage. We hadn't had a romantic relationship in 10 years after I got back from Desert Storm. I don't usually talk about that because her and I is not any of my group's business. But we didn't have a romantic moment for the last 10 years when I got back from Desert Storm. She didn't step out or nothing. She's a wonderful woman, and I love her. But I wasn't in love with her, and we divorced. I gave her everything, and I took the file cabinet of bills. I married a woman that's not an Alcoholics Anonymous. Today is our 5th anniversary. She thinks it's great that I'm here because when I come home, I'll act better because I've been around you. A lot of people in my group, that she knows them. She loves Clancy and Johnny and Larry and Rosie and Cindy and Sharon. She knows all the people in our group, and she says, they're really nice people. I said, no, they're not. And she says, yeah, they are. And I said, no, they're thieves, whores, convicts, mental patients, malcontents. They're not nice. She said, yes, they are. Look at what they've done for you. That's it right there. She knows, and she ain't even in AA. I act better at home because of you people. Her and I have had a good 5 years. I've never raised my voice in that house. I don't cuss in that house. I have a 12-year-old stepson. He'll be okay when he gets out of the duct tape when I get back. At age 65, I didn't want to be raising a 12-year-old. But you know what? I don't have to act with him the way I did with mine. I get a chance to be his stepfather. His father was abusive and mean and really tormented that kid and my wife. He don't have that with me. That's because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I get an opportunity time after time after time, if I stay here, to continue to make a living amends to the people that mean the most to me. My daughters, even my ex-wife, my present wife, my friends, the people around me. I'm a very blessed man, not because I'm special, because I'm not. I am not a good person. I told you what I'm like, and trust me, that's what I'm like. But I absolutely love Alcoholics Anonymous. There's nothing I wouldn't do for my sponsor. If you're new in here tonight, your sponsor will never tell you to do anything that's going to hurt you. I have never, by anybody in AA, been told to do something that's hurt me. Everything I have been told has benefited me. It's quieted my head and calmed my stomach. It has put me in the center of life. And I have a good life today. I got a lot of things going on medically and everything. A lot of people do. I've had good things and bad things happen when I made amends. And direct or by letter, I got to write a letter and send them, or I make a phone call. I have done the things I've had to do to clean up inside me so I have a place for my God to live. Because he ain't going to live in a dirty house. And so I usually try to keep my house clean. I do a lot of things that I probably shouldn't do a lot of the time. The only thing that has never changed for me in 28 years is my commitment to this program. Nothing can stop me from going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, shaking the hands that I shake, doing my commitments. Instead of sucking the life out of the meeting, I try to give something back, because we got enough people that just come in here and take. I am grateful for the things I've learned from the people that come before me. I hope that I can only pass it on to the people that come after me. If you're new or used sitting here tonight, the steps will work for you if you put an effort into them. I didn't use the word easy tonight. There's nothing in Alcoholics Anonymous that's easy, but the payoff is far greater than any effort you'll put into it. Remember this. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path.
All of them sober more than 10 years. And they were arguing about some kind of, I don't know, some kind of unrelated matter. And we dropped in there and said, we're from headquarters. We have these incident reports here. And one of the guys looked at the other guy and he said, God damn it, Bill, I told you we shouldn't have done that. Way too much fun. How about wet myself? And we just did that for 2-3 days. And I'll tell you, then Mike, my delegate host sponsor, I guess you'd call him, he took me to a guy's house in the very southeastern corner of the state. Leon McGarity was his name. And this old man, he received me. We went down into his man cave, which is a shrine to Alcoholics Anonymous. And we sat there and we talked and visited, and he told me a little bit about his story. He'd come to that area in 1947 and sobered up and helped start AA there. And then he produced a letter from Bill as a result of him meeting him in Cleveland in 1950. And said, paraphrasing, and the letter was dated, I believe, 1951. Mr. McGarity, I can tell you how appreciative we are of the fact that we were able to meet. I appreciate your efforts on behalf of Alcoholics Anonymous in the southeastern corner of the state of Louisiana, or Missouri. Said, it is my greatest hope that one day one of our trustees would be able to come and see you where you are and to greet you and to thank you personally. And I looked at that letter and I looked at him and he was crying. And he said, I got this letter in 1951 and it's 2007. It's about time. And that was an unintended deal. That wasn't supposed to happen. That was just one of the little joys in the journey, you know, we got. And I got home and I thought, I need to send him some acknowledgement of this. I am not a trustee. What you see before you is not a trustee. I served you as a trustee. One look at me would tell you, you don't want my kind of cat in New York City. I ain't wired right for that deal. I'm not. But I believe in the groups. I believe in Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe in all of our principles. And I believe in our execution of those principles to the best possible standard that we can have. And I am so sick and tired of selling this thing down for good. Yeah, we do a lot of good things. And the good is going to kill us. Because if it ain't the best and if it ain't top shelf, in my mind, it's not Alcoholics Anonymous. AA is the best there is. So because of the fact that you asked me to do this for you, and because of the fact that I know in my heart of hearts that you trust me, I sent a letter back to Mr. Leon, and I said, Leon, on behalf of the General Service Board, on behalf of alcoholics everywhere, those that are here, those that have gone before, and those that are yet to come, I want to thank you personally for your sacrifice, for your labor, and for your love of this fellowship. Same to you. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Gary. That's great.